All right, we need to go to the next unit. We went all the way through the skeletal system chapter in one lecture, so we're now to the muscular system. And just like last time, we should start with discussing the major functions of the system. What are the functions of the muscular system?
To provide motor function.
Right, movement is the major function, right? Muscles pull on bones, and that allows the bones to bend at joints, and that allows us to move around. So that one is pretty easy to guess. What are there any other functions, though, of the muscular system? That's definitely the most important. Well, there's at least a couple more. There's, to a certain degree, there's protection as a function, and particularly in the abdomen, the anterior part of the abdomen. There are layers of muscles that they're there for movement, like all skeletal muscles are, but they also are like a sheath protecting below the skin, in deep to the skin, but protecting the viscera, the organs of the abdomen. And one more that we've talked about in here already. What else do your muscles do for you? Right. Thermogenesis is the production of heat. And we do that when we shiver, right? So shivering is muscular contraction, not for the purpose of moving something intentionally. It's uncoordinated muscular contraction that just causes friction, and that heats you up if your body temperature is too low and brings it back to normal, part of homeostasis. Now, in the first slide, we are looking at three muscle tissue types. There are three muscle tissue types, but be careful with this, because even though they're all muscle, and even though the organ system we're studying is called the muscular system, only one of these three types of muscle tissue is actually included in the muscular system. Muscular system does not include cardiac muscle, and it does not include smooth muscle. It includes all the skeletal muscles and the tendons that those skeletal muscles connect to, but that's it. No other kind of muscle. So this is in the chapter along with the muscular system, but not all of it is muscular system. The pictures that you see should look familiar, because you've already looked at histology slides for all three kinds of muscle tissue. Cardiac muscle is so named, of course, because it makes up the heart, and that's why it's not part of the muscular system, right? It's part of what system?
The circulatory system.
Correct. And smooth muscle is actually is found in multiple systems. Most of it is in the digestive system, because the job in general of smooth muscle is to form muscular linings of hollow organs, and by contracting it squeezes on those organs and pushes the contents through. Another example is the uterus, which is part of the reproductive system, right? It squeezes the fetus out. Yeah.
So for like the exam, I mean, I know it's good to know like about them, but it won't be focused on cardiac and like smooth.
Oh, I can't say that. Everything I talk about is fair game.
Okay.
The cardiac and smooth muscle tissue is obviously different, not just in the fact of what organ system it belongs to, but it's histologically different from skeletal muscle, which is why it looks different in these pictures and the slides that you've already looked at. It functions differently as well. It's not just that it's built differently. We talked a little bit about this before, but let's go through it again. First of all, there are multiple names, and they're interchangeable. You can use any one of them, but there's multiple ways you can refer to a muscle cell. You can call it a muscle cell. That's one possibility. You can call it a muscle fiber, which really means a cell in that usage of the word fiber. You can also call it a myocyte, Myo, wherever you see that, either myo or mys, M-Y-S, means muscle. Myofiber is the name of a muscle cell, another name, and myocyte. So a muscle cell, muscle fiber, myocyte, they all mean the same thing. Anyway, to compare the three, myocytes for skeletal muscle are cylindrical, non-tapering cylinders, like a pencil, basically. And they don't branch. Now, both skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle are striated. You learned that before. You see those lines. You see it also in cardiac muscle. But in cardiac muscle, the striations aren't all lined up like they are in skeletal muscle, because cardiac myocytes, as opposed to skeletal myocytes, are cylindrical and branched, whereas skeletal muscle is cylindrical and it does not branch, and therefore the striations all line up with each other. Now, something that's unusual about skeletal muscle cells compared to most of the cells of your body is that they are multinucleate, which simply means that they have more than one nucleus. You're used to thinking of a cell having a single nucleus, right? There are exceptions to that, though. Your red blood cells are exceptions to that. They are enucleate, meaning they don't even have any nucleus. They start out their lifetime with a nucleus and other membrane-bounded organelles, but they get rid of them in order to make room for as much hemoglobin molecules as possible. So they don't have any nucleus. That's a weirdness. Well, skeletal muscle cells have multiple nuclei. This makes sense because they really start out what we call a single muscle cell in adulthood or after development starts out as multiple cells situated end to end, and then they fuse together. And so the individual cells that they start out at each have one nucleus. When those fuse together to form one very long cell, it becomes multinucleate. They're extraordinarily long cells compared to most. You know, most cells are invisible because they're tiny in all three dimensions. But a single muscle, skeletal muscle cell, even though it's invisibly thin and, you know, in two dimensions, it's as long as the whole muscle is. So, for instance, on the rectus femoris muscle right here, one cell is this long. And that's why it's made up of multiple cells originally that fuse together end to end. Skeletal muscle cells, like all muscle cells, contract or get shorter. They shorten. That's the only thing that any muscle is able to do actively, meaning the only thing that's able to do on its own is to shorten. No muscle ever is able to actively lengthen. They can't push. They can only pull. So if after a muscle shortens, the only way for it to get long again is for some external force to stretch it back to its longer length. And that can be because some other muscle pulls on a bone, which then pulls on the original muscle and lengthens it again. Or if you just, for instance, if I contract my biceps brachii, that bends my elbow. And if I just stop doing that, if I stop contracting it, I'll remove the force and gravity will just stretch it back. But the muscle is not actively lengthening. No muscle can do that. So that's true of all muscle, including skeletal muscle cells. But skeletal muscle cells do not contract ever unless they get a signal to do so by a neuron. So all skeletal muscle cells are innervated. That's a word that simply means connected by a neuron of the nervous system. Innervation. And only if that neuron fires, meaning, but what I mean by fire is send an action potential, a signal, to the muscle cell, will that muscle cell contract. And that's under your conscious control. So you have to intend to contract your muscles, your skeletal muscles. Or at least a signal has to come from the nervous system. Sometimes you're not really thinking about it consciously, but you're controlling them. That's not true for the others. Thankfully, we don't have to remember to beat our hearts, right? The cardiac muscle cell, the cardiac muscle tissue is autorhythmic. I've told you this before. That simply means that it contracts on its own and over with a certain frequency. This is why if you cut a heart out of the body, it will continue to beat even though there's no neurons connected to it. It'll beat at a certain frequency. And it would beat at that frequency in the body without cutting it out, without the help of the nervous system. But obviously, a certain frequency is unchanging frequency would be inappropriate, right? Sometimes you need the heart to speed up, sometimes you need it to slow down. So even though it is autorhythmic, it is its contraction, its force of contraction, and its frequency of contraction are both modulated by the nervous system and the endocrine system. Smooth muscle is also autorhythmic. And you don't have to think about moving the contents of your gut from farther down the line either. That's automatic. And so that happens in waves of contraction that are much lower frequency than the heartbeat. It happens over minutes rather than seconds. Now into slide 2, we can look at the anatomy, still comparing the three types of tissue, but notice that the skeletal muscle has a hierarchical arrangement, a bundled arrangement, very much like a cable. A cable is a big bundle of smaller bundles, right? And then those smaller bundles, when you look at it, those are bundles of even smaller fibers, the wires that make up the cable, right? That's the same arrangement as in a skeletal muscle, except they're not spiraling through it like in a cable. They're just straight lines. But what we call a muscle, like the biceps brachii that I was using as an example, that's a whole muscle. Okay? The whole muscle has a name. And you'll be learning the names of some of them later. That has a certain length. It depends on which muscle it is how long it is. But the whole muscle has a certain length. From one tendon that connects it to one bone to the other tendon that connects it to the other bone. Okay, now that is a bundle. That whole muscle is a bundle of smaller things. Those smaller things, what you see several of them here, but one of them is sticking out. That's called a fascicle. A fascicle is just one of the bundles within the whole muscle. But the fascicle is itself a bundle. You can see on the one that's sticking out that it's made of smaller bundles. And those smaller bundles are individual cells. In other words, myofibers. Okay? So the whole muscle is a bundle of fascicles, and each of those individual fascicles is a bundle of myofibers, or cells. Now, each of these levels within this hierarchy is covered by a connective tissue membrane. So the individual cells are surrounded by a membrane called endomysium. Notice the M-Y-S, meaning muscle. And endo means inside. So these are the deep ones around individual cells. Okay? Then The whole fascicle that many cells bundle into, the one that's sticking out here, for instance, and all the other fascicles, each fascicle is surrounded by its own membrane, which is called perimysium. Peri means around, like in perimeter. And then the whole muscle is also surrounded by its own membrane, which is called epimysium. Epi means over, like in epidermis, over the skin. Okay, so those are, there's endomysium around the other kinds of muscle cells as well for cardiac and smooth, but those are, that's the definition of those terms. Now, if we compare the three in slide three in terms of how fast they contract, that's what these graphs represent. Skeletal muscle has the fastest contraction. Now, it can be very fast, like when you accidentally touch something hot, right? That's pretty quick contraction. But also, you can intentionally make it slower because you're controlling your skeletal muscles. So there's a range. Cardiac muscle doesn't have very much of a range of the speed of contraction. Now, you definitely do adjust the frequency of your heartbeat, but that just means how far apart you're spacing the contractions. Each individual contraction still happens at about the same speed. And it's a slower contraction than skeletal muscle, on average. And smooth muscle is by far the slowest. It contracts very gradually, comes up to a peak that can last minutes, and then will relax again and do it again later. Okay, now for the rest of the chapter, we're just focusing on skeletal muscles. So now we're officially only in the muscular system. And we see the hierarchical arrangement that I was just talking about in slide four. We also see, of course, that the muscle does not connect directly to the skeleton, the bone. It connects directly to a tendon, which is totally different tissue, right? And then the tendon connects directly to the bone. And that's true on both ends. What kind of tissue is a tendon? It is dense fibrous connective tissue. And there's one other word that you can make that make an even more specific description. It's not irregular, it's regular. Remember that regularity refers to the fact that the fibers are all aligned in parallel, whereas the dense word means that there's a lot of fibers packed in a small area, small space. So that's what makes it strong, the denseness. And the fact that it's regular means that it is strong in particular in one direction because they're all aligned. That's appropriate for a tendon, right? Because a tendon is always going to be pulled in the same direction. It's the only way that muscle is going to pull. It doesn't have to be strong this way because it's never going to be pulled that way. So it's dense, regular connective tissue for tendons. The muscle itself, we can see a better view of this hierarchical arrangement. And that hierarchy continues beyond what I've said. The whole muscle is a bundle of fascicles. Each fascicle is a bundle of myofibers, which are individual cells. And you see one muscle cell or myofiber sticking out. Well, in the next slide, we'll see that it itself, even though it is one cell, it is really a bundle also. It's a bundle of molecular structures smaller than the cell that run along with it. But all of these divisions are the same length. The whole muscle is a certain length, like I said. Well, all the fascicles that make it up are the same length, just like, the individual wires in a cable are as long as the entire cable. So the fascicles are the same length as the whole muscle. The myofibers, or the individual cells within the fascicle, are also the same length as the whole muscle. Okay? And if we go to the next slide, we can see how the hierarchy continues. So in slide five, we're really, really close up. This is a single cell, and we're only seeing a little bit of its length. But this width that you see, the diameter of this would be invisibly small because this is one cell. So this is one myofiber of many that make up one fascicle. And what I was saying just before, you can see now, even a single cell is itself a bundle of smaller things running through it. And these are called myofibrils. So be really careful with the two words myofiber and myofibril. A myofibril is really an organelle. It's smaller than the cell. It's just part of the cell, right? Whereas a myofiber is the cell itself. It's another name for a muscle cell. Now, these myofibrils are made of various kinds of proteins. That's mostly what they are, is protein. And we'll look at those in a minute. But there's many, many myofibrils making up one myofiber. And just as all those other things were the same length as the whole cell, I mean the whole muscle, myofibrils are the whole length of the muscle as well. Now let's go to 6 and look at a single myofibril in detail. This is not nearly the whole length of it. This is a tiny bit of its length. But notice that these lines that are transverse with respect to the myofibril, those are what you see as the striations. What we have here, well, let me start that sentence over. A myofibril, a single myofibril, one of many that make up the cell, is a long thing. It's as long as the whole muscle is, like I said. But it is made of short subunits that are all hooked together. Very much like the cars of a train. Right? You have one long train, but it's made up of many cars that are hitched together. In this analogy, the cars of the train, the train itself is the myofibril. The cars of the train are called sarcomeres. Sarco, by the way, whenever you have that in the word, means flesh. A flesh eater, for instance, is someone who eats the muscle of animals. So when, you know, mostly, if you eat animals, mostly what you eat is skeletal muscle, unless you eat organs like kidneys or whatever, or liver. Anyway, a sarcomere, a single sarcomere, is just the part of the myofibril between one Z-disc, Z-disc, and the next Z-disc. There's many, many Z-discs along the entire length. So this is just one sarcomere right here. We have part of a sarcomere here and part of a sarcomere here as well. But those are like the cars of the train. All right, and they're all hooked together just like in a train. They're complex. The Z-discs themselves are complexes of proteins. There are the myofibril, which is already, you know, that's another level of this hierarchy of bundling. The myofibril itself, really, when you look at it on end, is a bundle also. It's a bundle of protein fibers that are called myofilaments, not myofibers, because that's the whole cell, right? Myofilaments are proteins, they're molecules. And they come in two varieties within the myofibril. Thick and thin are self-descriptive names, but the thin myofilaments are made of a protein called actin, and the thick myofilaments are made of a protein called myosin. Okay, now in this cartoon, the thick filaments, the myosin myofilaments, are the red, dark red bands, whereas the blue ones are the thin filaments, the actin filaments. And look at their arrangement with respect to the sarcomere. The thick or myosin myofilaments, the dark red ones, they are centered within the length of the sarcomere. And by the way, the very center of the sarcomere,
which is the A band within the H zone.
These letters refer to German words, by the way, because the Germans were the first to figure this out. So Z stands for Zwischenscheibe, which means disc between. H is hell, which is bright, because it looks brighter. Anyway, you don't have to know those names. Anyway, the H zone actually has something that's called the M line in it. Mittel means middle in German. That's right in the middle of the length of the sarcomere. And that is where the thick filaments are centered, right on that middle. Okay, and then they don't go the entire length of the sarcomere, but they go quite a bit of the distance. The thin filaments, on the other hand, the actins, which are the blue ones in this cartoon, are anchored on a Z disc, either one Z disc or the other Z disc. And they extend toward the middle, but not all the way. Okay, you see that? And importantly, the thick filaments and the thin filaments overlap a certain amount. Reason I say that's as important is because even though the myofibrils, and therefore the whole muscle, will contract, get shorter, the myofilaments, thick and thin, actin and myosin, do not change their length. They do not shorten. Instead, what causes the muscle to shorten is that the amount of overlap between the thick and thin filaments increases. So this isn't a perfect analogy, but if you think of my hands the way they're arranged right now, with my thumbs representing Z discs, so this is one sarcomere, and my fingers represent thin and thick filaments, if I overlap them more, that's going to bring the thumbs together. The Z discs are getting close to each other. That makes the sarcomere shorter, even though my fingers aren't getting shorter. They're just overlapping more. That's how muscles shorten. And it's because there can be an interaction between thick filaments, myosin filaments, and thin filaments, actin filaments. And I'll explain how that works in a different slide. But that's the basic anatomy of a sarcomere, and there are many, many, many sarcomeres along the whole length. So it's, in this train analogy, it would be a hell of a lot of cars, more than you would really see in a real train. Now, the amount of shortening that one sarcomere undergoes is tiny, because the sarcomere itself is not very long. But when that shortening happens, it happens in all of the sarcomeres in that whole myofibril simultaneously. So one sarcomere shortening is not much of a difference, but that tiny amount times the hell of a lot that there are adds up to a lot of shortening. It would be like instantaneously shortening all the cars in the train at the same time. The whole train would get much shorter. All right. Now we're getting into molecular detail here, which is, hopefully you follow me. I'm not going to get into as deep a detail as you would in another class, but it's still going to be kind of detailed next few slides. Okay, in 7, we're even closer up than in the previous slide. This is a single sarcomere, as you see labeled, but now we're so close that we can see a little bit more detail of the individual molecules, the myofilaments themselves. Thick filament in red and thin filament in blue. And the thick filament is an arrangement of proteins that look kind of like golf clubs. A shaft with a head at an angle to the shaft. And you can see the club, the head-like, in fact, they're called myosin heads, coming off of the shaft. So it's like a bunch of golf clubs bundled together, each with its own head. Okay? Those myosin heads, as they're called, are at an angle compared to the overall long axis of the thick filament. And the thin filaments are proteins as well. You don't see the detail right here, but many places along the length have what are called active sites. Active sites are just places on the thin filaments, the actin filaments, that are able to bind to one of these golf club head looking myosin heads. That's how the two kinds of myofilaments can interact. They temporarily bind to each other. And they do that easily if they're near each other, but only if there's nothing in the way preventing them from doing that. Okay? Yeah, go ahead.
Is the yellow portion part of the myosin?
It's a different protein entirely. It's called elastin, and it acts like little springs, which is how it's built. I didn't mention it because it's not that it's not important. It's just I'm giving you enough detail anyway. And it's not important to understanding how they contract. It's the contraction is really about the interaction between myosin and actin. Okay, so let's look at this interaction. Well, first, I have to go to 8. We'll get back to the interaction in a second. But first, slide 8. The concept being shown here is what we call a motor unit. Now, I said before that when we were comparing the muscle types, that skeletal muscle cells have to be connected to a neuron because unless they get a signal from a neuron, they will never contract, unlike the other muscle types. And we can see here, this is part of the spinal cord, and you have nerves coming off of the spinal cord. Well, what we call a nerve is itself a bundle. It's also like a cable. A nerve is not a cell. A nerve is many individual neurons, each of which is a cell, and they're all bundled together in parallel. So what we have here in blue is just a single neuron of many that are bundled together in that nerve. Okay, that's one neuron, and you looked at neurons before, and I talked about them on the slides. Remember that a neuron, I'll just draw it in schematic form, has a cell body, that's where the nucleus is, and then it has an axon, right? The axon is the long part of the neuron that the signal is sent along. And those signals are electrochemical signals called action potentials. More about action potentials in a minute, but each neuron has an axon, but that axon can, it doesn't have to, but it can branch into however many branches. It depends on the neuron. Okay? Since it all starts as one axon, though, that means that if this neuron does fire and creates an action potential signal, that signal will be sent to all of those branches. And therefore, everything that those branches connect to will get that signal. Not just one branch and not the other, right? All the branches will. Well, the very ends of these branches are called axon terminals, which simply means the ends of axons. And those are what connect directly to skeletal muscle cells. We see that right here. These are the ends of these are axon branches right here, and the ends of them, the axon terminals, are in contact with the muscle cells individually. So if this purple neuron fires, then that means this muscle cell, and this muscle cell all will be told to contract. And that's the idea of a motor unit. A motor unit is one motor neuron, the nerve cell, and all of the skeletal muscle fibers or cells that it connects to. So in different muscles, you can have large motor units, meaning that there's a lot of branches, and therefore it will simultaneously tell a lot of muscle cells to contract at once. And you can have small motor units, not very many branches at all. So you're just that single neuron is just telling a couple cells only to contract. And the reason that's important is because you have small motor units, like in your fingers, where you have to be able to make very delicate movements. And in larger muscles, like in your thigh, you can have bigger motor units because you don't really make real delicate movements with your thigh. You want to, we call it recruiting, or causing muscle cells to contract is recruiting. Big motor units recruit a lot of those muscle cells to contract at once. Okay? But the point is, for any given motor unit, if that motor neuron fires, then every one of the skeletal muscle fibers that it's connected to will contract, not just some of them. Okay, now we can get back to the molecular detail of how all this works. This is slide 9. The middle picture here is just a close-up of this. And this bulb-like yellow thing, that is the very end of one branch of the neuron, of the axon. So this is an axon terminal that I was talking about. Now, I mentioned action potentials. I said they are electrochemical signals. But what is a potential? Well, it's another word for voltage. You know, just like voltage that you can measure on an outlet on the wall. That's an electrical voltage. It's an example of a gradient. Remember we talked about gradients a little bit already? A gradient is a real general word, meaning a difference in some measurement at two different places, right? So I said that a pressure gradient exists. That's why the water comes out of the faucet, because there's higher pressure in than out. That's a gradient, a pressure gradient. Concentration gradients are what cause diffusion, right? You have higher concentration of solutes one place and a lower concentration somewhere else, so it'll diffuse. Well, a potential or a voltage is also a gradient, but it's a gradient of charge, electrical charge. So there's more positive charges one place than another. That's a voltage, okay, or a potential. All cells actually have voltages, all living cells. And the place is the two different places where it's measured. It's not just random. The voltage is across or through the thickness of the plasma membrane. So you measure the charge on just the very outside of the membrane and just the very inside of the membrane. And if there's a difference with respect to charge in those two places, then that's a voltage. And all living cells actually have what are called membrane potentials or voltages. But those are not action potentials. Action potentials are membrane potentials that drastically change from moment to moment. And remember the four types of tissue that we talked about, right? Only two of those four types of tissue are called excitable tissue. Excitable tissue is tissue that is able to produce and send action potentials. So what are the two excitable tissues of the four total tissues? Muscle tissue is excitable. And nervous tissue. Yeah. They both produce and send or propagate action potentials. Even though the other cells do have voltages, those voltages don't change. Okay? The voltages in neurons and in skeletal myofibers change from moment to moment. That's what action potentials are. Okay? And that's the signals that get sent originally in a neuron along its axon toward the muscle cell. Okay? Now, that occurs originally in the neuron because you are intending to move the muscle, right? You make the decision, I want to bend my elbow. That creates an action potential in a neuron. And we'll talk more about how that happens in the neuron in a different chapter when we're in the nervous system. But for now, just believe me that an action potential gets created. And the propagation of an action potential is really kind of a chain reaction. There are individual action potentials. So if this is like an axon, an action potential gets created here, and then that causes an action potential here, and then here and here, like dominoes falling. And that's happening all the way down the length of all the branches. Here we're looking at just one branch, end, an axon terminal. So an action potential reaches this finally. Okay? What is the direct result of that? Well, an action potential is a change in voltage. So when this part of the neuron, the very end of it, senses that change in voltage, the result is that proteins in that membrane that are acting as channels through which calcium ions can move open up. So the direct result of the neuron's action potential reaching the terminal is that calcium ion channels open up. And when they open up, that allows calcium ions through. But the direction they flow is from outside of the cell, right here, through the channels and into the axon terminal. So that's an influx, or an inward flow, of calcium ions into the neuron. Everyone with me still? Okay, now what does that do? Well, the calcium ions coming in, that's another signal to the cell. In response to that signal, the inflow of calcium ions, there is exocytosis that happens. So think back, we already talked about exocytosis, right, and endocytosis. Do you remember what those are examples of? What kind of transport?
No, facilitating.
Neither. Vesicular transport. Vesicular transport is transport involving a vesicle, right? And exocytosis is specifically vesicular transport that moves something out of the cell via a vesicle. Well, speaking of vesicles, before this even happened, there already were vesicles ready to go in this axon terminal. That's what these little bags are. And notice they contain little green dots in the cartoon. Those little green dots are neurotransmitter molecules. Neurotransmitters are chemical signals just like hormones are, except that hormones get released by glands into the bloodstream and travel all over the body. Neurotransmitters get released from neurons and just affect only that immediate area. They don't get broadcast throughout the body. But they're chemical signals, okay? And specifically, the chemical signal that these green ones are is abbreviated ACH. That stands for acetylcholine. That's the specific neurotransmitter that is released by motor neurons to signal skeletal muscle cells. But right now where we are, there is no muscle contraction yet. The muscle does not know yet that the neuron is telling it to contract. We're not quite there yet. I said, though, that these vesicles were already prepared ahead of time. So there's a bunch of vesicles, each that contain many acetylcholine neurotransmitter molecules. They just need to get the signal to release that bag out of the cell by exocytosis. And that's what the influx of calcium tells the cell. Okay, the action potential causes the influx of calcium ions, and then the calcium ions coming in causes the exocytosis of these vesicles, releasing the acetylcholine. Now, I need to give you a little bit of anatomy before we go on. This yellow thing is the axon terminal, so that's part of the neuron, that's one cell. This red down here, that's the interior of the skeletal myofiber, that's a muscle cell, that's a different cell, right? And the blue region between the two is outside of both cells. It's not inside a cell at all, that's extracellular fluid, okay, between the cells. This whole arrangement where the neuron comes together with this muscle cell is called a synapse, which is a word that means come together. But It is not an actual mechanical connection. Notice there is this gap. So a neuron does not actually come into physical contact with the muscle cell. It comes very close. This is a tiny, tiny gap. So really close up, but it is a gap. And that's why this gap is called the synaptic cleft. Okay? That's extracellular fluid because it's outside of the neuron and it's also outside of the muscle cell. Well, when this exocytosis happens from the neuron, the acetylcholine molecules get spilled into this synaptic cleft. So they are outside of both cells now. And when I first told you about chemical signals, using hormones as examples, I said that no chemical signal can have any effect unless it binds to a protein acting as a receptor. Anyone remember me saying that? Which is why I think I gave you the example of oxytocin for feedback, for childbirth as positive feedback, right? The head stretches the uterus, that sends a signal to the brain which releases oxytocin into the blood. That oxytocin goes all over the body, but the rest of the body doesn't even know it's there because it doesn't have the receptors for oxytocin. The uterus has receptors for oxytocin, so it responds by squeezing even more. The head stretches the cervix even more, and it keeps building. That's what I gave you as an example. But the reason that the rest of the body doesn't respond is because there's no receptors, and no signal will have an effect unless there's a receptor. That's true here, too. The acetylcholine is the signal now, and so in order for that to have any effect, it needs to bind to a receptor that is specific for acetylcholine. Well, those receptors are found embedded in the membrane of the skeletal muscle cell, just on the other side of the cleft. They're the little purplish things, okay? They're part of the muscle cell. But they're proteins that have just the right shape to accept these green acetylcholine molecules and recognize that they're there, okay? So when that happens, the acetylcholine binds to the receptors. That opens up these proteins that are acting as the receptors, and they serve as channels themselves. We talked about the calcium channels up here in the neuron. These are also channels, but for a different ion, not calcium, instead sodium. Okay, so when these things open up, sodium ions can pass through them. And they, you can see this on the bottom, in, on the close-up view below it, sodium ions come into the, when the channel opens, sodium ions come into the muscle cell from the synaptic cleft. All right. That doesn't happen unless you have an acetylcholine there binding there first to open up the channel. So only if the neuron fires will you have the acetylcholine released, and only then will these sodium ion channels open up. But if that all happens, notice what that means. Sodium is an ion. It's a positive ion, right? It has positive charge. So if all of a sudden you put a bunch of positive charges on this side of the membrane, in the inside, you have changed the voltage, right? Because the voltage is a difference in charge from one side of the membrane to the other. And so what that causes, when enough sodium ions come in, that causes a brand new action potential in this excitable cell, the muscle cell. You already had one action potential in the neuron. Well, it ended, and that caused the release of a chemical, and now that neurotransmitter, and now that is causing a brand new action potential in the muscle cell. And just like there was propagation of the action potential down the length of the axon to begin with, this new action potential that gets created in the muscle gets propagated down the whole length of the muscle cell. And that is going to eventually, we still haven't gotten to the point of any contraction, but that's eventually going to cause the sarcomeres to shorten all along the length, because that action potential is going to cause that indirectly. Now, did you follow all of that so far? We're not quite done with the detail, but that's what's happening. And it takes a while to describe this, but it happens in a tiny fraction of a second. Right? It's very, very quick in the body. All right, let's go to 10 then. This is the sarcomere that we already looked at. The top view is basically the same picture. The bottom view is the same sarcomere, but after it has shortened. And so this is really just showing you the same thing I was trying with my thumbs. No myofilament is getting shorter. They're just overlapping more in order to get it shorter. And the reason it shortens is because the actins are anchored to the Z-discs. So if they get pulled by the myosins toward the center, the actins will drag those Z-discs toward the center, and that will make it shorter. So that brings up the question, well, how do these golf club head-looking myosin heads drag the actin along toward the center? And that's what we need to look at now. Slide 11. So in this cartoon, we have the blue actins, those are the thin filaments, the red myosins, and we can see the myosin heads sticking out. And remember earlier I said that a myosin head, if it's near the active site or the binding site on an actin, it will bind to it easily, but only if there's nothing blocking it. Well, at rest, before contraction, there are proteins in the way, blocking those active sites, keeping the myosin head from binding to the actin. And those are listed here in purple as regulatory proteins. All right? These proteins are, in this situation, the active sites are blocked because the place where this myosin head could bind to the blue actin is right where these purple proteins are in the way. And that's what's keeping the muscle relaxed, because the myosin head cannot grab on to the actin. All right? So something needs to move those regulatory proteins out of the way in order for the myosin to bind to the actin. And that is actually the result of calcium. We already talked about calcium being important in the neuron. It's also important in the muscle. Calcium, if it gets released into the cell, it will bind to these regulatory proteins and move them out of the way. And that will expose little active sites where the myosin heads can bind to the actin. Okay? So that brings up the question then is, how does the cell know to release these calcium ions onto the regulatory proteins? Well, that, the release of the calcium, is the effect of the action potential in the muscle cell, which has just been created, right? After all the stuff we went through, the muscle cell itself is now creating an action potential, a change in voltage. And that change in voltage is what causes calcium ions to be released into the main interior of the cell. Up to this moment, the calcium ions were in the cell, but they were all sequestered away in a little thing called the sarcoplasmic reticulum, which is really just a special name for the endoplasmic reticulum of the muscle cell. Okay? So it's like a bag within the cell where calcium ions are held while the cell is at rest. When the action potential comes along, that tells the cell, release those calcium ions into the main interior of the cell, where they can then bind to these regulatory proteins and move them out of the way. All right, let's look at what that looks like in slide 12. Red here is the calcium ions, the red balls. Once they get released in response to the action potential, they bind to the purple regulatory proteins, and that causes them to change shape and move out of the way. And now that exposes these little active sites on the actin where the myosin heads can bind to. Okay? Still no contraction yet, but we're getting really close now. The myosin head binding temporarily to the actin active sites, that's called a cross bridge. So the moving out of the way of the regulatory proteins allows for cross bridge formation. All that does, though, is bind the two together. It still hasn't contracted because there's still no movement. But when cross-bridge formation occurs, that causes... Notice the difference between 12 and 13. Notice the difference in the myosin heads. The angle changes, right? And that's what happens when cross-bridge formation occurs. The myosin heads, once they bind to the actin, change their shape, and the angle changes. So they get dragged this way. And since they're connected to the actin, that drags the whole actin toward the center of the sarcomere. And remember, on the other end, it's connected to a Z-disc. So this Z-disc gets dragged toward the center. And the same thing's happening in the other direction here. This actin's being pulled also toward the center, but from the left. And its Z-disc gets moved toward the center. So the whole sarcomere gets shorter. Is that all clear?
Yeah.
Okay.
I have a question.
Yeah.
When the muscles cramp up, why do they cramp up? Because there's a lack of... Because they say potassium, your muscle needs potassium.
Yeah, it's usually an ionic imbalance. And that makes sense because the ions are causing these voltages, right? Mm-hmm. So when that's causing neurons and muscle cells to fire, cause action potentials when they're not really supposed to be.
That's like they're like firing at the same time. So like the,
right.
The neurons need to fire first, and then when the action potential reaches the muscle, that's when they go, not at the same time, because they counteract each other?
Well, the neuron action potential occurs first, that releases chemicals, and then the action potential in the muscle is created.
Okay.
But actually, in an imbalance, you can have action potentials abnormally created without the neurons' input, simply because the ions...
Or imbalance.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And that's why, you know, if you get a cramp during a football game or something, they give them Gatorade or salt water.
Yeah, have a whole bunch of them.
Exactly.
Okay.
It takes a while for that to have an effect, but it will.
So is a spasm, is that an imbalance?
No, a spasm is actually happening just as I described it. It's just that the neuron is firing for some reason, even though you didn't intend for it to.
Oh.
So it's something is causing that neuron to fire, and the muscle can't tell whether you wanted that to happen or not. It just obeys the neuron and it will contract. And the same thing when you're dreaming, right? You feel yourself doing this, you wake up, and it's because your dreaming is causing the brain to fire as though you're actually doing something when you're awake, and therefore your muscles are obeying. Okay, now that's done with the molecular detail. Hopefully that was manageable for you. Here we're looking at the whole muscle again, and I told you earlier that both ends of the muscle are connected directly to tendon. They aren't connected directly to skeletal bone. Even though it looks like it in this figure, this end of the muscle still has a tendon. It's just a much shorter tendon than this longer one down here. Okay? But the more important point of this slide is to show you that in almost all cases, a skeletal muscle will cross over a joint, a movable joint of the body. Which makes sense because the whole idea of the muscle shortening is to bend that joint to allow for movement of the skeleton. But also, each skeletal muscle has two connection points. And those get different names. One end is called the origin, and the other is called the insertion. Now, it's really not the ends of the muscle. Technically, it's the ends of the tendons, right, that they're connected to. But there's an insertion end and there's an origin. The origin, I mean, the way you know the difference, because it's not always based on the direction of, you know, you can't say superior is the origin and inferior is the insertion. It just depends on the muscle. But the way you know the difference is that the origin pretty much stays put, whereas the insertion is connected on the bone that actually moves when that thing pulls. Okay, just like in the elbow example. This is the humerus. You should already know that from last meeting. And what is this one? What bone is this? The ulna, right. So and this is the brachialis muscle, named for the fact that it's in the brachium, right? It's in the arm. But anyway, it inserts onto the ulna. It doesn't originate on the ulna. It inserts onto the ulna. It originates on the humerus. And when it contracts, the humerus is going to stay in position. But when it shortens, it's going to pull on the ulna, and the ulna is going to move. So the insertion end is really the part that drastically changes position. That's what makes the difference. All right, let's go to 15. Now, we've made it through the part of the chapter that's really an overview of the organ system itself, plus that histology stuff that we started with. The rest of this chapter, which is still obviously part of the chapter and therefore important for the upcoming test, this is also, from here on out, important for the lab. Okay, so keep that in mind. We'll start with some, in slide 15, with some major kinds of motions that contractions of skeletal muscles can cause. So there's different motions depending on several things that I'll talk about, but most of these occur in antagonistic pairs or opposite actions, all right? And that includes this first pair, which is flexion and extension. They're opposites of each other. Now first, be careful with flexion, or flex, the verb. Because we use the word flex to refer to contraction of muscle. Or at least, not really so much within anatomy and physiology courses, but just in everyday life, we say flex a muscle, right? That just refers to make the muscle contract. Well, every one of these actions that I'm going to give you occurs because you are contracting muscles. So that's a totally different use of the word flex. Flexing the muscle happens for all of these actions. But flexion, the action that's occurring in the skeleton, is a specific thing. Okay? And here you have to remember your planes of dissection. Remember the three major planes? Okay, now, what she is doing and what I'll do in actual motion for flexion, and it doesn't have to involve the arm or the upper limb, but it can. So she's doing this. This is the anatomical position, first of all, right? If she's doing this. That is flexion, and this is extension. But notice, as I'm doing this, that there's only one plane that my limb is staying in. What plane is that? No, this is frontal. So I'm going, I'm not staying within this. And no, it's not transverse either. That's this way. No, that's another name for frontal.
So sagittal.
Sagittal planes go this way, right? So a plane this way, I'm staying in. You see that? The movement is occurring in a sagittal plane. Everyone understand what I'm saying there? Okay. So flexions and extensions occur in the sagittal plane. It's not necessarily the shoulder that you can extend and flex. You could do the same with the head or the thigh or the fingers. Right? Those are all occurring in the sagittal plane. So what makes the difference between flexion and extension? Well, flexion decreases the angle of the bend, and extension makes it bigger. So actually here on the shoulder, you kind of have to imagine this is the other half of the angle. So right now it's a 180 degree angle, right? When I do this, I'm making it less and less, right? Here I'm making it bigger again. So extension undoes flexion until I get back to the anatomical position. And in certain parts of the body, you can go beyond that. And that's why you have also hyperextension possible. Not necessarily possible everywhere. For instance, the elbow can flex and extend. But skeletally, I'm prevented from hyperextending very far because the end of the ulna runs into the humerus. Okay? You don't want to hyperextend the elbow, but certain parts you can. So that's flexion and extension, opposites of each other. And 16 just shows you this with the head. The head can also be hyperextended. You can go beyond the anatomical position, right? But that's the difference. They are opposites. Notice that they're all in the sagittal plane, though, as we've talked about. Okay, 17. Here we have rotation. There's rotation possible at several places in the body. A pivoting. And we call it all rotation, but obviously you can undo rotation with a rotation in the opposite direction. Right? So remember I was talking about the bones involved in rotating. In shaking your head no. What bones are involved in that? Flexion and extension of your head, nodding yes, in other words, that is because of movement between the skull and the first vertebra. What's that first vertebra? What is it? Yes, C1, that's another name for it, but it goes by a special name. No, that's not a vertebra. That's up here in the throat. The atlas. Because it holds up the globe, meaning the head, right? That's why it's named that. So that's between skull and atlas, the flexion. The no motion, which is rotation, that's between the atlas and the axis. They're swiveling with respect to each other. But that's rotation, and you can also rotate other parts of your body, like if you stand on one foot, you can rotate your femur a little bit. Rotation. It's pretty straightforward what rotation is. Now to 18. Here we have another pair of opposites. Adduction and abduction. Be careful with them because they differ only in one letter. But using the limbs, like the upper limbs like she's doing, it's not the only thing that can be adducted and abducted, but doing what she's doing, which is this, what plane is this staying in? No, transverse is this way. So I'm going through many transverse planes when I'm doing this, right? Which one? This is frontal. Frontal or coronal is this way, right? You see that I'm staying within a coronal plane? Is that clear what I'm doing? Okay. So abductions, it's not?
No. I'm going to take your word for it and write it down, and I'll have the knowledge for a test.
Well, do you remember the pieces of glass-looking things when you... Well, the coronal one is this way. And if you make it a thick one, I would still stay inside it if I'm doing this, right?
Okay.
But I wouldn't stay inside a piece of glass going this way if I'm doing this.
Okay. If I think about it in terms of you staying within this piece of glass...
Yeah. Got it. That's the plane. So this is in the abduction and adduction is within the coronal plane, whereas flexion and extension is in the sagittal plane. Okay? So what is the difference between the two? Well, abduction with a B is movement of the part farther from the midline. You're taking it away. Just like abduction is another name for kidnapping, right? You're taking the kid away from the parents. And adduction is bringing it back toward the midline. It undoes abduction. This is abduction. This is adduction. So that's happening at the shoulder joint, but you can do the same movement of other parts of the body staying within that same plane, right? You can abduct the fingers and adduct them. You can abduct the lower limb and adduct it. So that is the difference between that and flexion and extension. Oh, circumduction, that's just a special word for what really is multiple movements. It's moving your limb in a cone shape like this. But really, when you get down to it, that is just flexion, abduction, extension, and adduction over and over. But we call that, we give that one special name, circumduction. 19. Oh. So what the hell happened? No, I have two slides that are identical. Huh. Well, that brings to 20. And 20 is a special pair of ones that apply only to the foot. Notice that this is also staying in the sagittal plane, so you'd expect it to be flexion and extension. Well, they mess up the names for you here. They both have flexion in them. But dorsiflexion is moving the ankle so that the toes are getting closer to the front of your body. And plantar flexion, remember plantar means of the sole of the foot, is moving it so your toes are farther away from your front of your body. Okay? And those are opposites of each other. But that applies only to the feet. You wouldn't use that for any of those words for any other body part. These ones in 21 are also applying only to the foot. So this is analogous to abduction and adduction because it's happening in the frontal plane or coronal plane, but we don't use abduction and adduction in this case. We use eversion and inversion. Eversion, which you can't do all that much, but that's pointing the sole of the foot laterally toward the side, and inversion, you're pointing it medially toward the middle. Like, and you can evert even more if you actually use the floor, but you have to be careful with that. That's what rolling your ankle is. It's drastically abnormal inversion, which hurts like hell. Okay, 22. We talked a little bit about this last time. This is pronation and supination. So this applies only to the forearm. And this is when you were talking about your, what was your mnemonic about soup and what was the P word?
Pronation.
Right, but what was the P? Oh, pour. Yeah, okay, that's right. So pronation and supination is this action. Okay, that's the pair of actions. So which is which? Well, this is the anatomical position, right? With my palms facing anteriorly. If I were in the same position, only lying on my back, that would be called the supine position. Whereas lying on face down is prone. Well, if I'm doing that with my palms, even though I'm not turning my whole body over, if I'm turning, imagine I'm on my back. If I just twist so that my palms are facing downward, that's pronation. I'm putting them into a prone position. And if I undo that and bring them back to the anatomical position or the supine position, that's supination. Okay? And those are opposites of each other. And like I said last time, it seems like what's happening is that you're moving your wrists. You're intending to move your wrists. But you're not. What you're doing is firing neurons that will cause muscles to rotate the radius. Remember that this is the radius? You have radius and ulna in the forearm. The radius is the one that's always associated with the thumb. No matter what position you're in, the radius is next to your thumb. And in the anatomical position, the radius and ulna are parallel to each other. And when you, and so that's in the supinated position. When you pronate, you're actually twisting, you're not moving this, you're twisting the radius with respect to the humerus. And since the distal part of the radius is connected to the hand, that drags the hand along for the ride. And now, instead of being parallel bones, the radius and ulna are crossed. Okay. Now, you can demonstrate also that it's not the ulna that does that by putting your elbow on a hard surface. That's the ulna that's resting on that, and I can still pronate and supinate, but this bone is not moving. It's the radius that's moving. Anyway, that's supination and pronation. In 23, we have opposition. So this will be the last one I cover. Opposition is a special, this is also a special one that applies only to the thumb. When you bring the thumb together with any of the fingers, it doesn't have to be a specific finger, but the thumb bringing together with any of the fingers tips, that's opposition. And that's why we say humans and other apes are special because they have opposable thumbs. That's what it means, thumbs that can undergo opposition. You can't get your dog to do this. It has a thumb, you just can't do it. Okay, so you don't see it here, but the opposite of that is reposition. Opposition and reposition. All right, let's stop there.